You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 27th of February 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show...
Total number of cast ballots, 587. 542 colleagues voted yes, 32 voted no. Abstentions, 13. The motion is hereby approved.
Germany's parliament approves an extension of Greece's bailout. A sign of hope or just another delay of the inevitable? My guests Michael Binion and Phil Clark will be in the studio to give their views. Also, we'll be discussing efforts to prevent extremists from travelling to Syria and explore climate change and ethics in the United States. And a little later in the show... A lesson in the blues with the author of a new visual history of perhaps the world's most resilient musical form. And grab your popcorn and sink into that red velvet seat. We'll be ending the show with our film review.
Sunny takes a roll call every morning.
Mrs. Evelyn Greenslade.
Here.
Douglas Ainslie.
Yeah, I'm here.
Norman Cousins and Miss Carol Parr.
Both here.
Mrs. Muriel Donnelly.
What's left?
From the second best exotic Marigold Hotel. Just one of the films up for discussion as critic Anna Smith joins me with her tips for the big screen. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. An action-packed hour ahead, as always, ahead of which Jonathan Wheatley has the latest world news.
The British Prime Minister has refused to comment on media reports on the identity of the Islamic State militant known as Jihadi John, who's appeared in several videos showing the beheading of hostages. He's been named as Kuwaiti-born Mohammed Emwazi, who grew up in London and graduated with a computer programming degree. It's reported he was known to security services for several years. Well, David Cameron wouldn't confirm his identity, saying everything possible is being done to catch him.
When there are people anywhere in the world who commit appalling and heinous crimes against British citizens, we will do everything we can with the police, with the security services, with all that we have at our disposal to find these people and put them out of action. That is the number one priority for me.
The Liberian president, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, has said that while her country's not yet free of Ebola, she's confident Liberia can reach the point of no active cases of the virus. She met the US Secretary of State John Kerry in Washington and praised the US decision to deploy thousands of US forces to Liberia to help battle the disease. At a UN Security Council briefing, representatives of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe have said that there is de-escalation in the Ukrainian conflict, but Ukraine's UN ambassador has insisted his country does not trust Russia's weapons withdrawal process and remains concerned. Speaking on a visit to Budapest, the British Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond agreed with Ukraine and was critical of the separatists.
Russia is not compliant with its obligations under Minsk at the moment. It is true that over the last few days, the level of open conflict has reduced, and we welcome that. But we see signs of separatist units regrouping, re-equipping, restocking. We do not see yet the signs on the ground of behaviour of units which are planning to disengage permanently from combat. So we have to be prepared for the possibility of a further assault.
Leonard Nimoy, the American actor who won a global following as Mr. Spock, the resolutely logical human alien first officer of the Starship Enterprise in the television and film series Star Trek, has just died at his home in the Bel Air section of Los Angeles. He was 83. His wife confirmed his death, saying the cause was the end stage of chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. Mr. Nimoy announced last year that he had the disease, which he attributed to years of smoking, a habit he had given up 30 years ago. He had been hospitalized early in the week. And Boko Haram bombers have killed 23 people as Islamist insurgents fight back against a military offensive launched by Nigeria and three neighboring countries. At a hospital in Jos, medical staff were kept busy treating the injured. Abdul Salam Mohammed is one of the emergency workers.
After depositing the corpses and the injured in the hospitals,
we met the most senior doctor on duty, and we inquired if they needed any assistance, which they actually needed, and they mentioned the items, mostly dressing items, dressing materials, and we had them in our MICU vehicle. We immediately released them to enable them to start treatment. And most of the injured people have been treated and have been admitted.
And that's the news on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. This is Monocle 24.
London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, Europe,
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 18.06. That's 13.06 in New York. Joining me now with their take on today's news here in the studio we are Michael Binion, former diplomatic editor of The Times, and Phil Clark, reader in comparative and international politics at SOAS here in London. Welcome both. We will start tonight in the Eurozone, where Germany's parliament has voted to extend financial aid to Greece for another 4 months. The extension still needs to be ratified by other Eurozone members, but Germany's endorsement was always going to be the important one. It may be, however, that Germany's lawmakers are at odds with their constituents. The front page of yesterday's Bild insisted no more billions for the greedy Greeks. Michael, I'll ask you first, is there any chance at all, do you think, that we won't be having a variation on this conversation 4 months from now?
Yes, well, the Greeks have got to go back for more money, and it's got to be rolled over again, and it's becoming more and more difficult to see whether there is an end in sight to all this. The Germans were increasingly reluctant to come up with this latest loan. A large number of Angela Merkel's own party voted against the measure. And as you say, there was a press campaign against it. For the moment, the Germans feel that they've got to back the Greek demand. In 4 months' time, or whenever the next tranche needs to be renegotiated, we'll see.
Phil, it's occurred to me more than once watching this ongoing saga, you know, the old joke which suggests that if you owe the bank £1 million, you've got a problem. If you owe the bank £100 million, the bank's got a problem. Is that the relationship between Greece and the rest of the European Union at this point?
It does seem to be one of an umbilical cord that isn't going to be cut anytime soon. And I guess the challenge for the Syriza party in Greece is this is a new government that presumably is still trying to find its feet, still trying to get a functional cabinet, still trying to work out how exactly you run a government, and suddenly it's got EU-wide pressure on it to get its house in order. That would be a steep measure for any new government, let alone this one. So difficult to see that it could really put these reforms in place in 4 months. So yeah, I would think this situation is going to roll on, and the EU is going to continue to have this problem for a long time.
Because Michael, I'm trying to understand where the patience of German lawmakers is coming from. I mean, Greece is not going to win the lottery in the next 4 months and suddenly be in a position to pay all its bills. Is the only explanation that strikes me is Germany just reckoning that breaking up the Eurozone will be more expensive than letting Greece run up the tab, and this is therefore the least bad of the available options?
Yes, I think that must be the calculation. The exit of Greece from the Eurozone wouldn't be quite as catastrophic if it happened now as it would have been, say, a year or so ago, when it would have actually wrecked the whole project, because it would have had an effect of bringing in a lack of confidence to all the other countries in difficulty, Spain, Italy, Ireland. They seem to be more insulated from trouble. But I think for Germany, it's more than just the economic difficulty it would cause. It's actually would signal a failure of political will, because the euro has always been more than simply an economic single currency. It's been a kind of symbol of growing political unity and growing cooperation between European countries. And the fact that it has so spectacularly failed, if it does fail, with Greece, means that it sets a precedent that not only one country, but others could pull out later if they wanted.
Well, that was what I was wondering, and I'll put this to you, Phil. Michael talked about there the euro as a symbol of political unity. Has it not also become, I guess, a symbol of political vanity, that nobody at the heart of the European Union project wants to admit that maybe it wasn't such a great idea after all?
Yeah, I think that's right, that there's been very little humility about this, and perhaps too that expansion happened too quickly, and that was a process that was very precious to many policymakers in Brussels, this idea that more and more states needed to be incorporated, and in some cases that meant taking a risk on very volatile economies, Greece included. So I think perhaps a little bit of humility about that wouldn't go astray at the moment.
I mean, a final thought on this subject from you, Michael. As you said, the Eurozone is more prepared for the idea of a Greek exit. I'm not going to say Grexit, except in the context that I just did, is more prepared than it was 2 years ago. But we still, leaving aside people's sort of emotional investment in the idea of the Euro project, the European Union is 28 countries, it's half a billion people. It can live without 11 million Greeks, can't it? Why are we still behaving like this is just an unthinkable calamity?
Well, it could live with them, certainly, and economically it would probably be better off. It wouldn't have to fork out all this money all the time. But it is the loss of confidence to all the other economies, and particularly it's the idea that if Greece left, it probably would leave without any reassurance that it will pay all its debts. And this would actually severely affect many of the other European countries, Germany not least, whose banks are owed billions and billions by Greeks. And if they allow the Greeks to get off the hook, then they feel they will never see that money again. It's also a question of pride, as we've discussed. And the other thing that is really on people's minds is it's horrifically difficult to negotiate an exit. You would have to have emergency capital controls overnight. You would have a huge flight of capital. You would have the economy in Greece plummeting overnight. All kinds of difficulties. And Germany would be blamed, and they don't like that.
Okay, well, I'm sure I'll see you both for a more or less word-for-word repeat of this conversation 4 months from now. But let's look now at Bangladesh, where for far from the first time in recent years, even recent weeks, some of God's biggest fans have decided that he's incapable of defending his own reputation. Avijit Roy, a US Bangladeshi blogger who wrote articles promoting reason and secularism, was hacked to death in a Dhaka street while attempting to attend a book festival. In 2013, another secular blogger, Ahmed Rajib Haider, was murdered in Dhaka in similar circumstances. Phil, we should note first and foremost that both of these murders have sparked huge demonstrations of solidarity and protest from Bangladeshis. But are we any closer to figuring out where on earth this rage comes from? I mean, it's been my own personal reaction to such events, going back to the Salman Rushdie fatwa, is a combination of, it's partly anger, but it's mostly complete bafflement. I mean, what is the problem? Someone doesn't agree with you.
Yeah, I would share that bafflement. I think what this shows is that anger goes extremely deep. I think in a country like Bangladesh, this isn't the first time that we've seen secularist authors killed. Perhaps only because of the Charlie Hebdo situation, there's a spotlight on this issue now. But actually, I think this has been rumbling on fairly consistently in places like Bangladesh for a very long time. And I guess a lot of the blame for this does have to lie with Islamic teachers and Islamic education system that builds in this idea that any kind of intolerance or any kind of critique, rather, of Islam is worthy of death. I think there's a set of values and a set of beliefs that lie at the heart of this. And the question that I guess we have to pose ourselves here is what is the solution to that? How do you start to target very deep-seated ideas and beliefs that I think many people grow up with almost from day one in their lives?
Well, the way that we have reacted, I think, or at least the way that the nominally secular West has reacted, certainly since the Rushdie fatwa was declared on Valentine's Day 1989, has been by trying to be reasonable and by making concessions and allowing ground and sort of extending, I guess, the idea that people may have reason to be upset. Michael, has that been a bit of a mistake? Have we just reached the point, or indeed have we passed the point at which that secular Western world just has to say, seriously, just stop it?
Well, I wouldn't say it's a mistake to make concessions. I think it's perfectly reasonable to suggest that perhaps it isn't a good idea to splash cartoons all over the front page of newspapers if it provokes the kind of hysterical reaction that we have seen that it did provoke. It is, of course...
But isn't that on the people who react rather than the cartoons? You get to decide how you react to something.
Well, you can decide how you react, yes, but surely it's a question of responsibility. I'm not saying it's wrong, of course not, because freedom of speech should be absolute. It's simply a question of responsibility. I would say, however, that trying to deal with a mindset that is so intolerant is extremely difficult, but it's not unusual. All you have to do is look back 500 years to Europe and look at the kind of extraordinary intolerance of anyone who disagreed, even with a tiny iota of the dogma propounded by either the Catholic faith or Protestantism or whatever. People burnt at the stake left, right and centre because their faith was not as other people thought it should be. And this had whole nations at war with each other. It had the Inquisition. It had all kinds of things. It was a mindset that was gripping Europe for the best part of two centuries. And I fear we are in something of that mindset with fundamentalist Islam at the moment.
Avijit Roy, it should be said, wasn't, not that I personally think it makes the blindest bit of difference, wasn't drawing offensive cartoons or particularly mocking or goading anybody. He was merely advancing reason and secularism, which is... Both strike me as self-evidently good ideas. But, I mean, this may be an unanswerable question. I'll put it to you, Phil, with apologies in advance. what is it that there does seem to be some strange of religious opinion that finds something about atheism in particular just utterly, not just intolerable, but actually threatening?
And I think that that's the case with all forms of fundamentalism, that I think Michael's exactly right, that various forms of Christian fundamentalism could be put in this category too, also feeling this threat in the form of atheism. I think it's a sense that it can't be controlled. And I think that goes to the heart of the issue here, whether that's with Islamic and Christian leaders or many of their followers, a sense that this idea of atheism, this idea of secularism is outside the fold. It can't be ordered in the way that followers can be. And so many inside the fold find that, I think, quite offensive and find it quite an imposition on their own faith structure. But I think much of this comes back to how we think about notions of disorder and diversity. And I think many fundamentalists find that very difficult to deal with.
My own possibly sort of obtuse view on that. I've always noticed that whenever you go to a party and there are some people dancing and some people aren't, you never see the people not dancing trying to persuade the people who are to stop. It's always the other way around. I just have this vague worry that as with the dancers, the religious have this idea that maybe they're wrong and look ridiculous, but if they can get everybody else to join in, that won't be a concern. That's just my personal view. Michael, the same question, I guess, because it's not just in the subcontinent. It's not just in the Middle East. Poll after poll in the United States has revealed that, all other things being equal, Americans would be even less likely to vote for an atheist president than they would for a Mormon, a gay person, or a black person. Again, the same question. What is it about lack of belief that so discombobulates those who do believe?
I suppose it's the fact that if you are an atheist, you don't subject yourself to higher authority. Your moral system is presumably relative. It's relative to society. Now, that could be perfectly acceptable. And in many ways, I think quite often such moral systems are perhaps more balanced than those that rely on religious teaching published 1,000 years ago. But the fact is that people would be worried that this could lead to a kind of man-based arrogance, and that they don't want to see a president they feel doesn't himself feel some kind of obligation of responsibility to some higher moral authority. That may be the reasoning by some people. Otherwise, I simply don't know. I have no idea why they are so hostile to that.
Unfortunately, I suspect that may be all there is to be said on that subject. It is baffling. I suspect it's not a storyline that's going anywhere in a hurry. And indeed, we will be revisiting it to a certain or less, greater or lesser extent, very, very shortly after this short break. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, along with Michael Binion and Phil Clark. When we return, we'll discuss, from another angle, extremism and prevention, plus ethics and our climate.
Thinking of starting your own business? Want to make your company a better place to work? Keen to sharpen those ambitions? Or just like some nicer business cards? Well, we know a handsome primer that will take you from fledgling firm to established brand. The new Monocle Guide to Good Business is a 300-page plus book packed with inspirational stories, wise advice, places to locate your new HQ, and of course, great photography and illustrations too. Head to monocle.com to order your copy now or visit any of our stores. The Monocle Guide to Good Business is a book that will show you how to do a job you really love, create a modest dynasty, use your hands and your brain, and even take your dog to work. Come on, it's time for a change.
Every Sunday, the Bulletin with UBS goes behind the numbers and the hype to explain what's really happening in the world of finance. Brought to you from the desks of the key analysts at UBS and experts from around the world, the programme delivers definitive insights into the people, places and products set to shape the week ahead. This is the show that explains how a fast-moving financial world really works. Set your agenda for the week ahead. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every Sunday at 1800 hours Tokyo time, 1600 hours London time, 11 a.m. in New York. Anytime after that, you can download from monocle.com and via iTunes or SoundCloud. The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me are Michael Binion, former diplomatic editor at The Times, and Phil Clark, reader in comparative and international politics at SOAS. This week, Britain has once again been puzzling about the relative attractions of war-torn Middle Eastern desert governed by murderous fanatics versus 21st century London. This follows the decampment to Islamic State-controlled Syria of three schoolgirls from Bethnal Green and the identification of IS's most notorious killer as a Q80-born 20-something from Shepherd's Bush. Michael, ask you first, in the modern era at least, in the last 20 to 30 years, European Muslims have been running away to war since Bosnia, which I, for one, would have argued was actually a fairly noble cause. But have we learnt anything about dissuading people in that time?
Not very much, I'm afraid. There have been some very interesting initiatives recently, and this is an extraordinarily difficult and complex subject, which is being talked about all the time in Britain. I was amazed to see in the Times newspaper only about 3 days ago, three separate stories on different pages, each of which had the headline, in the headline, had the word jihadist, which shows the degree of worry about what is going on. The latest approach is de-radicalisation doesn't seem to work, because at that point people are already gripped with this idea that they have to go and become a martyr or whatever. What you need is to provide some kind of immunity so that people don't get even infected with the idea of extremist philosophies. And there have been a couple of things that I think have been quite interesting recently. I just happened to be in Cairo last week with the head of the British Council, which is Britain's cultural organisation, and he signed, I think, a very important deal with Al-Azhar University, which is the main centre of Islamic learning, which trains young imams for all over the world. And this deal was to teach intensive English to these young Muslim graduates so that they would be able to blog and tweet in English back at the fundamentalists to reply to the stuff coming over on the net. And therefore, they could answer some of the very seductive messages that are being put out. And they could do it in English. It's no good doing it in Arabic. Apart from the Arab countries, nobody outside will listen. And English is overwhelmingly the language of the internet. Now, that is a smart thing to do, because that is going at least two steps further back from de-radicalisation. It's trying to say, protect people against nonsense coming over. The other thing is there have been a number of colleges set up now to try to give young imams a kind of sense of values of the West, which is for those living in Europe, where they're going to be living, working and teaching. And again, this is to give people confidence in the values of the society in which they live, instead of having people trained in Muslim theology, living in a sort of bubble in Western society, in which case many of them feel ill at ease, alienated, and the moment the call comes over the internet, run off and join the jihad, join the cause, off they go.
All of which are noble and interesting ideas, but Phil, I just wonder if it becomes a thing that starts to feed on itself, in that the more officially sanctioned attempts you make to de-radicalise or establish the immunity that Michael was talking about, the more the lure of jihad then becomes enticing to a certain sector. It's a bit like putting those stickers on records saying young people shouldn't listen to this record.
Now, this is the tension with all approaches to de-radicalization, is that they're usually run by the governments who inside of Muslim communities are perceived as the problem. You can't have a UK government, for example, that is seen as acting egregiously towards Muslims in the Middle East, also turning around and telling Muslim populations in the UK how to behave and how to think. So I think there's a fundamental problem there, which is why I personally think that, the change has to come from within the Islamic community itself, with, if anything, a very light touch by Western governments. One of my PhD students at SOAS, Bakindo Atta, is doing some, I think, really important work on de-radicalization around Boko Haram in northern Nigeria. And the experience that he's seeing is that the most effective de-radicalization is coming from critical imams themselves. It's coming from inside of the community. The U.S. government is trying to engage in this process, but those imams are blocking the U.S. and saying, stay out of this. You're part of the problem. We need to do this on our own terms. And I think that the UK faces a very similar challenge at the moment.
That's probably entirely reasonable. How much patience should Western governments and indeed Western societies show with waiting for those Muslim communities to sort these things out themselves, though?
Well, I think the noise is pretty intense at the moment. I mean, it's made clear to every single Middle East Muslim leader that the West expects them to do something. And in fact, some of them have started reacting. There was an important conference in Saudi Arabia only a few days ago, at which they gathered together religious leaders, including the Sheikh of Al-Azhar Mosque, and said to them, you have to understand that the fault lies within Islam itself. And you guys have got to sort it out, or rather us guys in Saudi Arabia and in the Arab countries. And indeed, President of Egypt, President Sisi, went up to Al-Azhar only a week ago, in January, and basically read the riot act to them. He said, our religion needs a revolution. There's something wrong here. And you guys have got to sort it out. Well, they have got to sort it out. That is the only way change will come from within. I mean, as Phil says, it's no good the Western government, telling them what to do.
Okay, well, finally tonight, we should look at an issue which could eventually render all of the aforediscussed concerns irrelevant as we struggle to cling to the remaining dry ground. Like everything else in America, climate change has become the subject of tedious partisan wrangling. By and large, Democrats believe it's a serious problem, while Republicans think it's a practical joke by attention-seeking boffins, who are also probably communists. Interestingly, however, a new poll finds that a handy majority of their citizens see reducing CO2 emissions as a moral imperative for their leaders and themselves. Phil, were you surprised by this? I thought it was the numbers were quite startling.
I was completely taken aback by this, that 66% of Americans believe that they have a moral obligation to do something about climate change. But I think when I looked at the reports a little bit more closely, it did start to make sense that the key here was that the difference to public opinion in the US, if this is framed as a moral issue in a way that can resonate, and this continues our theme of fundamentalism here, that it can resonate with particularly a Christian fundamentalist audience in the US. And the key here seems to be around notions of custodianship, this idea of the children of God being custodians of the earth, and they therefore have an obligation to the earth, but also an obligation to God to look after this earth, and so therefore climate change matters. So I think that is a sea change. If we start to understand the mindset of the audience, it might force different groups in the US who are advocating for a response to climate change to change their message and to kind of reach this audience in a different way.
Michael, does it suggest that maybe the debate, at least in America, has been framed wrong, that instead of bickering about whether the science is accurate or not, although every scientist you would care to ask would argue that the science obviously is, and I'm prepared to take their word for it, should it always have been framed as a moral thing, just saying, look, think what you like, but obviously reducing pollution cannot be a bad thing to do?
Yes, probably. I think I'm open to persuasion on this one, because my immediate reaction on hearing this story was that this is pious tosh, that actually it's never going to be a moral debate. It's a sort of scientific thing. It's a government action is needed. But in fact, if we frame it in a way that is understandable to people who would react in the way where they would take it on board, that probably would be quite effective. And probably the analogy would be smoking. If you just put up all kinds of posters saying smoking kills, smoking is harmful, people tend not to take much notice. But if you begin to get a kind of moral disapproval, people who do smoke feel somewhat ill at ease because their peers disapprove.
I mean, I think that the difficulty for the kind of climate change lobby industry in the US that's been advocating for change for a long time is that in using a scientific argument, in the US that equates to a debate about evolution versus creationism, that there's this kind of skepticism of science per se, which has been very difficult for that lobby to penetrate. So I think, again, taking this particular audience in mind, a shift towards a more moral argument seems to be the more effective one. I mean, I came across a fantastic website today of an organization called the Evangelical Environmental Coalition. I mean, goodness knows what these guys look like, but they seem to be one of the lobby groups that's trying to tap into that particular audience.
Well, I can see you can say we are children of God's planet. We have no right to destroy God's work. I mean, you could put it in those sort of simple terms, and atheists or not might indeed be on board.
I feel like that's kind of where we came in. We will have to leave it there. Michael Binion and Phil Clark, thank you very much. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Plenty coming up in the next half hour, starting with our Tunis correspondent shortly after the break.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Дете е Monocle 24.
Лондонист, Нью Йоркист, Токиост. Се е Monocle 24.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Monocle 24 дес.
Лондино, Нью Йорк, Токио.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It's 21:31 in Moscow, 18:31 here in London, 16:31 in Rio. Time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Today it's the turn of Tunis, from where I'm joined by Navina Kotour. Navina, Libya has come up, a few times over the last few weeks on our programs, as there's been a kind of gathering chorus of people from certain sectors of the Italian government to the president of Egypt, suggesting that the rest of the world does need to start getting involved in this. A UN panel of experts is about to agree with them, I understand.
Yes, they're certainly about to agree with them that when it comes to the sea, to the shore side, that it's almost impossible for the Libyan government, and in fact there are now two Libyan governments in place, to stop the illicit trade in oil or the flow of weapons in and out of the country. And there has been a weapons embargo in place for the last 4 years. But what this UN panel has been saying is that it's been impossible for the government to stop the flow of weapons, which have been used to arm not just the rebels or militias in Libya, but also now forces that have aligned themselves with ISIS. So it's expected that this UN panel will make a recommendation that there should be a sort of international maritime force to help the Libyan government deal with this.
It's one thing, of course, for the UN to recommend things. It's quite another for the UN's member governments to actually put up their own money, manpower and material to make them happen. Who would be the most likely or useful contributors to such a force?
Yes, exactly. I think that's going to be, we have to wait and see. And obviously the Egyptians and the Italians are leading, as you've already said, the call for international sort of action, international intervention there. I think the Brits and the Americans and the European governments are not very keen on putting any boots on the ground or any kind of, you know, intervention by air. But I think a maritime force, probably supported by the Italians, supported by the Egyptians, and maybe even supported by some other Arab countries, is looking quite likely.
Okay, well, moving on to another story you wanted to talk about. We were discussing earlier in this very program today the difficulties of deterring young British people from running away to Islamic State-controlled Syria. Tunisia has a similar problem, of course. Tunisia has now been rounding them up.
Yes, Tunisia has been rounding them up. As you say, the border with Libya is wide open for Tunisians and wide open for Libyans. And the Tunisian government is concerned about the fact that radicalized Tunisians might go over to Libya to join groups, militant groups that have either aligned themselves with ISIS or with other militant groups there. So there were a number of arrests. 100 people were arrested this week, and there have been similar arrests all over the country. It's fair. Tunisians don't need a visa to cross over. Libyans don't need a visa to come over. So it's part of a crackdown by the government that's trying to kind of tackle this as much as it can and trying to secure the borders as much as it can.
How big a concern is this for, I guess, not just the Tunisian government, for Tunisian people as well? Tunisia, relative to other post-Arab Spring states, has it's held up okay. Is there much worry about not, I guess, just Tunisians running away to join Islamic State, but Islamic State attempting to set up shop in some capacity in Tunisia?
Yes, there is a real concern about that. And I mean, it's very difficult to verify these kind of reports, but there were some government officials suggesting that ISIS camps were actually 45 minutes away from the Tunisian border, and it would be fairly easy for people to cross over. And also, I think the government is concerned about the number of Tunisians who have gone to join and the fight against the Assad regime in Syria, who might come back radicalized, who might turn against its own population. The problem here is really that it's very difficult to get a reliable figure of how many Tunisians we're talking about. There has been a figure of 3,000 mentioned at the beginning, but that's looking increasingly unlikely. But the government, as well as the public, is very much concerned about what radicalized Tunisians could do if they were to come back or if they're already here. And they're very much afraid of the kind of attacks we've seen in other countries.
As well as these 100 arrests we've been discussing, have they done, I guess, the obvious things? Like you mentioned, that incredibly porous border between Tunisia and Libya, and obviously patrolling the entire thing and sealing the entire thing, I'm sure, would be impossible. But have they stepped up military presences on border crossings and made it harder for people to fly in and out of Tunisia without people knowing they've done it?
I think there is a level of surveillance here, and we know of jihadists who have tried to travel to Syria via Turkey, who have been taken off the plane in Istanbul on the journey, who are now under police surveillance, who need to report to the police every single day. When it comes to this border, this is something that is underway. It's a military that never really had to secure the border in the way it has to now. And it's also a military that's really not properly trained in counterterrorism operations. So this is something that the European government and the US government are actually supporting the Tunisian government in. And it's very difficult to say how successful this is and how effective they are at protecting this border.
And just finally, the ongoing attempt to get PayPal set up in Tunisia. I think most people hearing this would be surprised to discover that there's any way that you can't use it. What has been the problem?
Yes, I have to say it's one of the most extraordinary stories I have been working on since arriving here. Tunisia is one of the few countries in the world, apart from North Korea, Cuba, and other countries where there are sanctions in place, that doesn't have PayPal. In fact, Morocco, Algeria, Egypt, they all have PayPal. And it's to do with the fact that the Tunisian currency, the dinar, is not freely traded, and the government is trying to stop or prevent people from taking their money out of the country. So it's a way of really securing their currency, but it also means that people who want to sell products online, who have an online business, programmers can't use PayPal to get paid or to buy software. And so there is a campaign underway now on social media, and there was a protest outside the central bank of software developers who are calling on the central bank to allow PayPal in their country, basically a service that's been around in other parts of the world for the last 10 years.
Is there any sign of the government budging on this? It is, as you say, in this day and age, completely extraordinary and peculiar that this is a thing.
I don't think the government is going to budge on this anytime soon, partly because I think the people who are deciding on this are not necessarily aware of how important PayPal is for people who are trading online, selling businesses online, who are software developers, and partly because they know the dinar is very weak and they are concerned about the dinar weakening even further. What is currently underway, and I find this even more amusing than the PayPal discussion, is I think you have to remember that Tunisians are also not allowed to use, they don't have international credit cards, so they can use the credit card in Tunisia, but they can't use it, for example, to buy a visa to travel somewhere or to buy anything from a different website. All these things are banned. So what the government is currently discussing is giving Tunisian software developers a 500 dinar, that would be around $280 per year, credit card that would allow them to buy some licenses for software and get access to the Apple web developer store. We know $280 doesn't travel very far when it comes to buying software. So I think this is kind of a sort of an attempt of the government to kind of keep the people quiet or appease them.
Navina Kotur in Tunis, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Up next, a celebration of the blues.
As the day draws down in Europe and the next morning begins in Asia, the Monocle Daily is on hand to bring you up to speed with a one-hour program packed with news, business and the best culture and design stories from around the world. Our presenting team in London are joined by guests in Monocle's New York and Toronto studios.
There's lots that the US and the international community can do, but it's enfeebled by its diplomatic and political shortcomings.
And as the sun rises from Tokyo to Sydney, we'll take a look at some of the more interesting front pages landing on doorsteps across the region.
The authority of the Chinese Communist Party has been challenged on its doorstep in Hong Kong, and they do not like it.
That's the Monocle Daily, every weekday at 2200 hours London time, in association with UBS.
On the menu, we explore the delicious, diverse, and eminently digestible world of food, drink, and hospitality every week. Join me, Marcus Hippi, as I meet everyone from the bakers to the makers who are redefining the culinary landscape.
Many people think that it might be gamey somehow because these are hairy animals that have horns, but it's quite the opposite. I think the milk has a cleaner, sweeter flavor than cow milk.
We'll also head to Kenji's kitchen for a roundup of restaurant reviews, interviews with top chefs, and trade secrets with our Asia editor at large, Kenji Hall, in Tokyo and beyond.
The beer market has been changing rapidly for some time now. It seems like almost every month, a new pub that specializes in craft beer is opening.
All that and even a dinner party soundtrack recommendation, so your ears are catered for as well as your belly. A healthy serving of the finest free-range fare to sate your radio appetite each week. That's the menu on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House, 1841 here in London. Now, everyone knows what the blues sound like. Most of us will have had some idea what the blues feel like. But the blues also look like something. In the 8 decades or so since Robert Johnson made his infamous deal with the devil at the junction of Highways 49 and 61 outside Clarksdale, Mississippi, the blues has evolved a distinctive visual vernacular, all of which is compiled and enshrined in a new book, The Blues, A Visual History. And its author, Mike Evans, joins me in the studio. Now, Mike, welcome to the show. Why did you feel the need for... we should stress it's not just a picture book. It is a big glossy book, but there's also a lot of text in it, a lot of essays and introductions to artists, etc., etc. But why the need or the desire, I guess, to do a visual history as opposed to just a book about the blues?
Well, there have been plenty of books about the blues, as you're hinting at. The visual side, as you've just said, is very rich, and obviously there are illustrated books with illustrations of blues record covers and posters and so on. But we thought it'd be good to get all those kind of visual elements together in one volume that covered the whole history, and also covering a lot of the areas that the blues influence, which people don't always associate with the blues. Country music, jazz, obviously, hip-hop even, punk and heavy metal, all these things wouldn't exist without the blues. And even things as formal as George Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue. So we tried to illustrate the blues influence as much as the blues itself. And of course, that opened the door to a lot more sort of illustration.
Well, that opens the door to pretty much everything. We'll come back to that because I was delighted as a massive, massive country music nerd myself to see that you had included what you called hillbilly blues and mentioned people like Bob Wills and Hank Williams. But given that you ended up setting yourself this incredibly broad remit, which goes all the way from Robert Johnson and Muddy Waters out to Jimi Hendrix and Led Zeppelin, how did you know where to stop?
Well, it was largely chronological in the sense that we stopped yesterday. So people like Joe Bonamassa and various people who are still preaching the blues, if you like, now, in the purest sense, they're all featured right at the end of the book. But it's an ongoing culture. It's not just history. It's not just Robert Johnson and Muddy Waters, but it's actually a live culture. And as I say, and all its influences are with us all around.
And how did you go about, I guess, not just sourcing the material you used, but compiling it? Did you have in your head a predetermined aesthetic of what the blues should look like on the page?
Not particularly. I mean, it was driven by the pictures that we knew were out there, and we had a very good designer, a guy called Paul Palmer Edwards, who, if you like, orchestrated that side of it more than I did. I pointed the designers in the direction of the kind of visuals that we needed, and the aesthetic, if you like, changed over the years anyway. I mean, the sort of blues of Bessie Smith was very archetypal 1920s, women in flapper dresses and so on. And so they were of their era. And of course, to me, like Jimi Hendrix is very archetypal of the psychedelic era. So the blues was contemporary to its era, and consequently its image or its imagery was contemporary to the era.
But is there, I guess, a... most genres have sort of a uniform that their practitioners feel obliged to wear to a certain extent. Everyone knows what a country music singer looks like and what a heavy metal singer looks like. Is there a blues singer's costume?
I'd like to say there was, but I suspect there isn't. I mean, there's the archetypal, there's the sort of stereotype of either the guy sitting on the back porch with a pair of overalls on, or a guy in a big flashy suit and a baggy sort of zoot suit, you know, that kind of thing in the 1940s. But they're kind of stereotypes that, again, pertain to a certain time and a certain type of blues. But I think the illustration of its universality is the fact that there isn't one image.
Okay. I mean, you were talking there about how you brought the story up to the present day. When you're talking about just the blues, I guess, in its pure fundamental form, as opposed to everything else which has been pulled out of it, which is, frankly, almost everything else that we think of as modern music, does that actual three chords in A, woke up this morning, variety blues still actually exist? Or is it now more of a heritage industry and more revered for what it's inspired rather than what it actually is?
Well, people would be surprised to find that, in fact, it is still the traditional blues, or the pure blues, if you like, you know, the 12-bar blues, is still very much a vehicle for, as I say, people like Joe Bonamassa and Keb Moe and Gary Clark Jr. These are people out there who are playing music that's either on that pure kind of structure or something very close to it, and something tangibly blues. Robert Cray, you know, you'd say he was a blues man. Mm. You know, you wouldn't say he was a soul man, or you wouldn't say he was a hip-hop man. He's a blues man.
Just finally, I guess, and I apologise in advance for the slightly impossible nature of this question, because I know how much I fidget whenever anybody asks me to name my actual favourite country singer, but do you have a particular favourite blues singer? Is there one that you keep coming back to above all others?
Well, my favourite isn't strictly labelled as a blues singer, purely because he had such a broad range of material, which is Ray Charles. I mean, Ray Charles, every note he sang was steeped in the blues.
And who made some fantastic country albums.
Made great country albums, show songs, rock and roll songs. And he did the lot, but every note he sang was infected with the blues.
You cannot argue with a recommendation for Ray Charles. Mike Evans, author of The Blues, A Visual History, which is out now and which looks absolutely lovely. Thank you very much for joining us. On that note, we will now play you some music, because it's that time of the show when we usually do. We will, of course, stay with the blues. This is Clarksdale's own McKinley Morganfield, better remembered as Muddy Waters, with Hoochie Coochie Man. the unmistakable muddy waters with Hoochie Coochie Man. You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, 1850, coming up for the end of the show, which means it's time for our daily arts review. Today we are talking film with the critic Anna Smith. Anna, welcome back to the show. You wanted to start, and I wanted to start as well, because it's an ambitious film about an important topic. This is Catch Me Daddy. It's about what I think are grievously misknown as honour killings. I can think of possibly more apposite phrases, but nonetheless, everyone knows what that means. This is a tough subject to take on.
It really is, and it's so well done. I was so impressed. It's a debut filmmaker, Matthew Wolfe, and it's set in Yorkshire. It starts very much almost like a kind of a realistic, romantic kind of drama. Sabine Jabin Alhad is fantastic as this British Pakistani girl who's run away with her white boyfriend. She's being pursued by family members who are keen to catch up with her. And then a thriller element sort of starts coming in the sort of closer they come. So it's a drama that turns into a thriller. Beautifully done, amazing soundtrack, fantastic performances, a sense of dread creeping up on you, and it deals with it very sensitively. But my gosh, it's grim. It's grim.
Well, it would be. I'd be astonished if you came here and told me it was a sort of like laugh a minute comedy romp.
Quite.
When you say it deals with it sensitively, this is a subject that is very, very difficult to get hold of without being obviously and quite rightly critical of the culture that endorses this sort of behaviour. How does it? Well, I guess, how does it approach that?
I think it keeps it very, very personal to her situation. It's not kind of making moral comments or cultural comments particularly. It's very much focusing on this one girl and her situation and trying to put us in her shoes and showing what she's going through. And without giving too much away, it leaves a few things open for judgment.
But worth seeing.
Very much worth seeing. Very strong film.
Okay, that's Catch Me Daddy. We will move along to something, when I say slightly lighter, by an order of magnitude. This is the second best exotic Marigold Hotel. This is going to be one of those films people take their mothers to see, isn't it?
Completely. I mean, the first one was a hit for exactly that reason. It's an OAP later life comedy set in India. Fantastic cast, you know, Judy Dench, Bill Nighy, Maggie Smith, all off to India again, making their lives out there. And, you know, second best is about right, but it's still ticks the boxes. It's very contrived, but it just has that kind of cozy, mature, sweet feeling about it that people, you know, go for.
Clearly they do. I mean, having seen the trailer for it, I just thought if you tried to put together 30 to 45 seconds of footage that would convince me never, ever, ever to go anywhere near a screening of something, that's pretty much what you'd come up with. But that is just me. We do, in fact, have more or less exactly that long an excerpt of the second best exotic Marigold Hotel. It goes like this.
The Marigold Hotel has been going properly for 8 months now. People who come and go, but there's been a core of regulars from the beginning, and Sunny takes a roll call every morning.
A most valuable precaution to ensure that nobody has died in the night.
Mrs. Evelyn Greenslade.
Here.
Douglas Ainslie.
Yeah, I'm here.
Mrs. Madge Hardcastle.
Here.
Norman Cousins and Miss Carol Parr.
Both here.
Mrs. Muriel Donnelly.
What's left?
Yes, the second best exotic Marigold Hotel. I suspect I may never know. Is it actually worth seeing, really?
If you like the first one, then yes. More of the same. I laughed quite a few times. You know, it's a sunny, sweet, harmless film. Quite amusing, but rather silly.
It sounds like Mamma Mia without the tunes.
Pretty much.
Okay. They can have that quote for the posters if anyone's listening. Finally, you wanted to talk about tonight, The Boy Next Door. I was somewhat disappointed to discover that it was not, in fact, a biopic about the young Nick Cave.
far from that.
A joke that people will get if they're au fait with mid-80s underground Melbourne rock. Actually, early 80s now that I think of it. I am getting old. It is, however, in fact, even more disappointingly... it's Jennifer Lopez. She will insist on acting.
Oh my goodness! And she will insist on picking the worst films. That's one of the reasons I wanted to talk about this.
Well, if you're making a good film, would you want Jennifer Lopez in it?
But Out of Sight, she was good, and she was actually good in that. But this is a terrible Jeopardy thriller about a woman that falls for the boy next door, who's meant to be 19 but is patently 27-year-old hunk, and it turns out he's a student and it's all illegal. So basically, he starts blackmailing her, turns into a complete stalker. But it is probably the worst scripted film I've seen in many years as a film critic.
Now, well, because if we are going to discuss Jennifer Lopez and badly scripted films, there is form. The title has been deleted from my subconscious.
Geely.
Was that the legendary one she made with Ben Affleck?
Yeah. It's as bad as that.
Oh, really?
It really is. It was, people were howling with laughter in the screening, and the press screening.
And not when they were supposed to be.
No, not when they're supposed to be. But, you know, it's not boring because it's actually, you know, it moves on a pace and the plot is absolutely ridiculous. But you're just kind of hanging on every word and just really, and looking at your friends going, seriously, did that just happen?
So this is a film which as films sometimes do, it's not, because most bad films are just boring. They're just,
exactly.
And you would know this better than most people because you must have watched an awful lot of them. Mm-hmm. They're just really tedious. Whereas this one, actually, it does go that step beyond.
I think it could almost reach the cult status. You know, you have a couple of glasses of wine, you go and see it, have a gig with your mates, but certainly don't go to watch it seriously. Don't spend too much money on it.
The Prince Charles Cinema here in London will do double bills with Gigli, won't it?
Exactly. That's what it's made
for.
That's
the thing that's going to happen. We will now subject our listeners to 30 seconds of this.
Kevin, did you send an email from my account?
Sounds like you've been hacked. You should really change your password.
Your father seems to be around a lot now, huh?
Yeah, I guess.
Don't forget that he walked out on you.
Honey, I need you to stay away from Noah, okay?
See you at school.
Sorry, guys. Oh, my God.
What's
going on? I'm gonna lose my job, my son, my life.
Oh God. Okay. I'm persuaded that it's terrible. Am I persuaded that I'm ever going to want to go and see it? Given that, you know, we're here anyway with a minute of airtime to fill. Can you explain the plot such as it is?
Well, the boy next door develops a crush and an obsession on her, and when she insists it was only a one night stand, he starts to blackmail her, threaten to tell the principal, and it's revealed that he is not a nice man at all. So it's one of those kind of fatal attraction in reverse kind of stories.
And I'm still trying to understand from this, is it actually supposed to be a thriller or a comedy?
It's supposed to be an erotic thriller. Not very thrilling, not very erotic.
The erotic thriller's not really having a good few weeks, is it?
No, certainly not.
No, and it's really not. And Boy Next Door apparently is not going to redeem it. We're coming up to the end of the show, and that's the end of our film review. We should, of course, mark the passing in this spot of Leonard Nimoy, who has died today, aged 83. Do you have a particular favourite Leonard Nimoy cinematic moment?
I don't know if I could pick one. He's just a legend, isn't he?
He really is. Leonard Nimoy, of course, best known for his role in Star Trek, but also a distinguished actor in many other films and TV series. And also, people forget this, made 5 entrancingly weird records, at least one excerpt of which we might play later on the Daily, if you're really lucky. Anna Smith, thank you very much for joining us. Leonard Nimoy died aged 83. He lived long and prospered. And that is all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our earlier guests, Michael Binion and Phil Clark. Today's show was produced by Marcus Hippie and Alice Block, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Lara Kunze. Our studio manager was Antonio Fernandez. You'll start recognising this music any second now. Up after the headlines, The Menu with Marcus Hippie. At 2200, I'm back with Ted Kravitz for the Monocle Daily, but for this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye. Thanks for listening.